Good morning. My name is Edward Burns, and I'll be moderating the second session on cancer genetics. Again, welcome.
And my hat's off, or my yarmulke's off, to the wonderful organizers of this fantastic symposium. This is the fourth one that the Medical Ethics Society of Yeshiva has put together, and each one has been fantastic, and a tremendous amount of credit to them. I, too, like Rabbi Brander, want to extend my wishes to my colleagues here, Rabbi Brander, Dr. Bacon, Dr. Ash, specifically for the people that heard Dr. Ash's talk. Her words were a little chilling and very thought-provoking, and for those of you who feel, oh, test for everything, I hope you give some credence to what she had to say. They were quite profound. So a couple of housekeeping issues before we begin. First, during lunchtime, for those people who want to have the sex selection process of diet that Dr. Brander mentioned and don't want to eat lunch, there'll be tours of the marvelous Gluck Center that is going on next door. So this is the new Beis Medrash and rooms for Shiurim, and it's just a marvelous place, and I urge people to take a look at what Yeshiva University is doing today. Second, I was given all sorts of instruction by Tali. She told me that there's going to be no questions because there's no time. So I'm going to ask each of the speakers to cut their presentations by an hour or two so that we can, in fact, have questions, because I'm sure much of what they're going to say is going to generate interest. So we'll try to take a couple of questions at the end. I was also instructed that each of the speakers had a small allotment of time, and that as soon as they get close, I'm supposed to sort of nudge towards them and remind them to stop short. But why should I do that? They're my friends and colleagues. Let the students do that. They're pre-meds. Their recommendation letters are already out there. They can't be hurt, so let them do it. So you're not going to hear that from me. So let's begin. So in the late 1980s and 1990s, cancer susceptibility genes were identified. And these genes, newly discovered at that time, were predictors of several different cancers, the most common of which were lung cancer, breast cancer, colon, prostate, and pancreas. So genes were discovered that if somebody had these particular genes, one could say that there was an increased susceptibility to some of these cancers. Now, increased susceptibility, of course, does not mean that a person's going to get it. There's certain odds, that, you know, maybe if there's a 1 in 10 chance if you have it, or a 1 in 50 chance if you don't have it. So they're imperfect. And the way these genes worked, the ones that were discovered in the latter part of the 20th century, were that they worked through something called tumor suppressor genes. So all of us, hopefully, in this room, have specific genes that are called tumor suppressor genes. They protect us from getting cancers. But if you have one of these other types of genes, the bad ones, they inactivate the tumor suppressor genes. So if you have one of these bad genes, like the BRCA gene, which you'll hear about, it may, in fact, have an adverse effect on these tumor suppressor genes. Without the suppressor, greater chance of getting tumors. But these tumor suppressor genes are actually quite rare. And in fact, since those times, hundreds, if not thousands, of new genes have been identified that have some small effect on the susceptibility to cancer. And how to interpret these genetic tests is a new and challenging problem that faces us all. For example, the two most common genes that you'll hear about in depth from Dr. Oster are the BRCA1 gene and the BRCA2 gene. Well, in fact, it causes an increased susceptibility to breast cancer and an increased susceptibility to ovarian cancer. But there's a problem, because we shouldn't be lulled into the concept that we should be testing for every single susceptibility gene, because not every gene test translates to a test for disease. So while there are tests for breast cancer, which we'll hear about, the increased susceptibility to pancreatic cancer that BRCA2 gene conveys, or the increased susceptibility to ovarian cancer that the BRCA gene pertains, doesn't really help, because there's not good screening tests for ovarian cancer and not particularly good screening tests for pancreatic cancer. So should we be testing for those genes that may incur increased susceptibility, but then you can't test for the gene. Points to ponder. Despite this, and despite the fact that there are problems like that, it is important for us to be aware of those tests that are really helpful. And thankfully, this morning, we have a panel of internationally renowned experts to deal with the ethical and the scientific and the halachic problems. Now, I was asked not to introduce the speakers, that their introductions are in the folders. And of course, since I'm not listening to anything else, the organizers are saying, it gives me great privilege to start to introduce the speakers one by one, because these are really a sterling, sterling panel. So our first speaker is Dr. Harry Oster. I'll give you a synopsis of what you'll find in your book. Dr. Oster is a professor of pediatrics and medicine, and he is director of the human genetics program at New York University School of Medicine. He practices medical genetics. He comes up with new genetic tests. He has been involved with the New York State Bar Association's Committee on Biotechnology and has actually written the laws that relate to genetic testing in New York State. Dr. Oster received his undergraduate degree from MIT and his MD degree from Columbia and was trained in medical genetics at Johns Hopkins. Dr. Oster has received awards from the March of Dimes and from the Weizmann School of Science. And for those of you staying for the afternoon sessions, he is my colleague and partner in crime in the Jewish HAPNAC project, Harry Oster. Great.
Thank you very much for that nice introduction, Ed. So I'm going to give you a very brief overview of cancer genetics, picking up where Dr. Burns left off, and then I'm going to touch on two very contemporary issues that I think are important, which will leave latitude for the other speakers to fill in with some of the issues that are of importance to them and that Dr. Burns has raised. Our best proxy for risk of breast cancer is family history. So breast cancer is higher among women whose close relatives have the disease. 20 to 30% of women with breast cancer have a family history of the disease. Having one first-degree relative, that is a parent, sibling, or child, doubles the risk. Two first-degree relatives leads to a fivefold increase in risk. And even having a male relative with breast cancer is an important aspect of family history. As undoubtedly all of you know, and as you heard from Dr. Burns, BRCA1 and BRCA2 are major risk factors for the development of breast and ovarian cancer. And they are the frontline genes that are commonly tested for. They aren't the only ones, though. There are other family cancer syndromes, which are highlighted in this slide. And we look for these in the process of taking a complete family history from the patients whom we see. Therefore, we believe that genetic counseling is an important part of the process of evaluating people for risk of breast and ovarian cancer. And you can see that if someone is a carrier for a BRCA1 or BRCA2 mutation, then their risks of developing breast or ovarian cancer or a second breast cancer following the first diagnosis or an ovarian cancer following the diagnosis of breast cancer is markedly increased above that of the general population. Just to cite one example, the risk of ovarian cancer following a first breast cancer diagnosis in a BRCA1 carrier is tenfold increased. Above the 2 to 6% that's observed in the general population. Now, the two issues that I would like to highlight during the rest of my talk are the Myriad Genetics lawsuit and the possibility for doing population-based screening for breast and ovarian cancer. So on May 12, 2009, six medical geneticists, four professional societies representing over 100,000 members, two genetic counselors, five cancer survivors, and four advocacy groups sued the U.S. Patent and Trade Office, the trustees of the University of Utah Research Foundation, and Myriad Genetics about the validity of the patents for the identification of the BRCA1 and 2 genes, their mutations and methods for detecting these mutations. And the U.S. Patent and Trade Office has granted thousands of patents on human genes. In fact, about 20% of our genes have been patented. A gene patent gives the holder exclusive rights to the use of genetic sequences. Patent infringement occurs when anyone who makes or uses the patented gene without the patent holder, whether for commercial or non-commercial purposes, she or he can be sued for the patent holder by the patent holder for infringement. Now, the major argument for patenting genes was that such protection would be required for the development of new drugs to treat human diseases. The cost of developing a new drug, taking it through clinical trials and marketing, can be in excess of $800 million. I wrote $800 billion in your synopsis, but that's not correct. It's $800 million, but still pretty expensive. By contrast, it costs about $25,000 to develop, approve, and market a new genetic test. Now, pharma and biotech companies would not undertake such expensive programs for drug development if they encountered significant competition from the start. At the outset, biotech companies indicated that they would not enforce patents for genetic testing because the financial margins for genetic testing would not be high enough to warrant enforcement. But Myriad changed that with its patent enforcement. On its heels, other companies have developed similar business models for sole source or limited source genetic testing. These include SMA and other neurogenetic testing by Athena Diagnostics. SMA testing is not commonly offered in Ashkenazi Jewish testing panels, touching on the previous session, such as the testing panel offered by Doria Shoram, because of its incremental cost, which is over $600. Because the patent has been granted on the genes themselves, the patent holders have a virtual monopoly over their patented genes. They can prevent anyone from testing or studying these genes. As the lead counsel for the ACLU has noted, and I should note that I'm one of the plaintiffs in the suit, so I'm not coming to this without a very strong point of view. The patents on the BRCA genes are particularly broad and offensive. The PTO has granted Myriad Genetics, a private biotechnology company based in Utah, patents on both BRCA1 and BRCA2 genetic sequences, on mutations along those genes, on any methods for locating mutations on the genes, and on correlations between genetic mutations and susceptibility to breast and ovarian cancer. As a result, Myriad's lab is the only place in the country where full sequencing testing is performed for patients. Others are prevented from conducting diagnostic testing or offering alternative tests. So Myriad's monopoly on BRCA1 and 2 genetic testing makes it impossible for women to access other tests or to get second opinions about their results. There is no price competition, so Myriad's charge in excess of $3,000 is unchallenged. Rather than promoting innovation, patented genes could stifle innovation. For example, large deletions, insertions, rearrangements are significant mutations in BRCA1 and 2. Myriad did not offer testing for these until after considerable pressure was applied by the genetics community, and then only for a limited number. New targeted mutation tests akin to the Ashkenazi Jewish multi-site 3 test could be developed for new Jewish groups. In the process, the cost of testing might be driven down, and testing for people without insurance might be affordable and available. Now, the major arguments of the lawsuit include, first, that genes are natural products and not novel and not obvious discoveries. Patenting a gene is like patenting noses or patenting oxygen. Patented claims on genetic information infringe on free speech. I could develop a new and improved method for genetic risk assessment that involved BRCA1 and 2 genetic testing, but my right for free speech for disseminating this information could be abridged by a cease and desist order. So at a hearing that was held by Judge Robert Sweet of the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of New York on September 30th, it was a hearing about the right to standing of the plaintiffs. Judge Sweet agreed to provide a ruling by the end of October whether the case would go ahead. And if his ruling is favorable, then it will move on to discovery and trial. Now, the second issue that I would like to touch upon is population-based screening for BRCA1 and 2 among Ashkenazi Jews. So in the September issue of the journal Genetics and Medicine, Dr. Wendy Rubenstein and her colleagues from Northwestern University Medical School published this article, Cost-Effective Population BRCA1 and 2 Testing of an Ovarian Cancer Prevention for Ashkenazi Jews, a call for a dialogue. So I thought that I would take Dr. Rubenstein at face value and promote a dialogue with you today. And her arguments are that almost half of Ashkenazi Jewish individuals identified with BRCA1 and 2 mutations have a negative family history for cancer. A genetic screening program would result in 2,811 fewer cases of ovarian cancer, with a life expectancy gain of 1.83 qualies. So qualies are quality-adjusted life years, a message that is a measure that's commonly used for looking at the efficacy of a particular intervention. And the cost of the program would be about $8,300 on a discounted basis per quality. Dr. Rubenstein's recommendation was based in part on this is running against a recommendation from the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, an agency of the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality of the federal government, that specifically recommended against routine referral and genetic counseling for people without a family history of breast or ovarian cancer. So this really is changing the dialogue on a national level. And Dr. Rubenstein's recommendation was based in part on an as yet unpublished study by Dr. Efrat Levy-Lachat from Shaar Tzedek Medical Center in Jerusalem. Dr. Levy-Lachat recruited over 7,200 men in her study and identified over 150 families with BRCA1 and 2 mutations. They counseled and tested the women in these families, many of whom were not aware that they were at increased risk and were not undergoing screening. Their results suggested the cancer risk for carriers are just as high in these families as from high-risk families with a positive family history. The website for the Breast Cancer Research Foundation, their sponsor for this study, noted that the researchers are continuing their study, and if more robust risk estimates remain high, they may determine if it is justified to offer BRCA1 and 2 testing screening in the general population. Now, I should note that similar studies are underway among Ashkenazi Jews in Toronto through Women's College Hospital and in the UK through University College London. Some have called this no-brainer testing. But is this true? Genetic testing without adequate genetic counseling can lead to fear and anxiety. Myriad Genetics conducted such a television marketing campaign in 2002. On the genome.gov website, under direct-to-consumer marketing of genetic tests, it was noted in Denver, one of the cities in which the ads ran, cancer genetic centers noted a 300% increase in calls from women interested in BRCA analysis, as it's called, but a 30% decrease in referral of high-risk women during the campaign. These data signal a potential failure of the ads to reach the targeted population of women most likely to benefit from the information gained from BRCA analysis. Further research showed that the advertisements did not accurately portray the test's ability to predict cancer or encourage consumers to contact their healthcare provider. Another concern in this is that the availability of such a program could create an elite status for Ashkenazi Jews, but not for other Jewish or non-Jewish groups where comparable tests are not yet available. So as Dr. Rubenstein has suggested, this is the time for a dialogue. And her strategy for doing this is actually pretty well considered. Here's the flow diagram that she presented in her article, which involves people signing up, having group educational sessions, having individual genetic counseling that looks at their risks. If they have a family history, they're treated one way. If they have a, if they don't have a family history, then they're treated a somewhat different way. But the key to this is that such a strategy would be built on the medical genetics and genetic counseling system that is in place already, and that it's not something that would be introduced willy-nilly into genetic practice. So I will end on that note and leave these two issues open for your consideration, whether the myriad patents on BRCA1 and 2 should be revised, and also whether population-based screening for Ashkenazi Jews ought to be undertaken on a large scale. Thank you all very much for listening.
I think this would be an appropriate time to invite questions from the audience on the issue of cancer susceptibility genes. Any questions? Yes.
I don't. if you give me your contact information, you know, I can send it to you. But I should note that the ACLU has a rather extensive website about the myriad lawsuits. So if you do a Google search or a Bing search, ACLU and myriad, it will take you to the website. And myriad is spelled M-Y-R-I-A-D.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
What is the point of testing? What can you do if you know that you have that gene?
Great. Yeah, I left that little detail out in my presentation because I was nervous that I was going to run over the time. There is, in fact, a lot that you can do if you have that information. One thing is that you can engage in a program of increased surveillance, especially for breast cancer. That's quite effective. As Dr. Burns mentioned, surveillance for ovarian cancer is somewhat less effective because most ovarian cancers, even with screening, tend to be identified at a more advanced stage. The second thing is that you can take drugs, estrogen modulators, that will lessen your risk for developing breast cancer. And the third is that you can have risk-reducing surgery, which is not a decision that is lightly made, but has clearly been shown to be life-saving for women, which involves having their ovaries and potentially even having their breasts removed. And I suspect that there will be much more discussion about this as the session ensues. Now, another feature I didn't mention, sorry, Ed, is that a priori, the likelihood that an Ashkenazi Jewish person will be a carrier for one of the three so-called founder mutations is 1 in 40, so it's high. You know, it's up there with familial dysautonomia carrier status as an example.
I have a hardball question for you.
You always do.
Yes. So is there a danger with genetic testing that if somebody gets a negative result, let's say BRCA negative, that they may put themselves in excess risk because they'll feel overly reassured and not undergo yearly mammography, et cetera? And how do you deal with that?
I think that's an excellent question. I wouldn't call it a hardball, though, because we confront that situation every single day. And so we do see people who come from high-risk families, and if we identify a BRCA mutation, then we have a basis for explaining the high risk. If we don't identify a BRCA mutation, then we don't currently have a means for reducing their risk based on family history. That's going to require the development of new genetic tests, which potentially could infringe on the Myriad patent, not to sound like a bit of a broken record on this theme. So we do encourage people from high-risk families who have a negative test to engage in increased surveillance. But thanks for that.